Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 221, I chat with Stereophile's John Iverson about blind audio testing. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 28th, 2014. Episode 221, a different take on blind audio tests. Help support TWiT with your Amazon purchases. Visit twit.tv/Amazon, click on the Amazon banner, and shop as usual. That's twit.tv/Amazon. And we thank you for your support. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is John Iverson, web monkey and writer for stereophile.com, as well as the other websites that are under the same umbrella, Sound and Vision, Analog Planet, Inner Fidelity, and AudioStreamAll.com. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here.
I'm sure glad you're here because we've got something really interesting to talk about this week. But before we do, I want to make sure that everybody knows that those who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, John, you and I have been friends for a very long time now, and recently we had a very interesting discussion that I wanted to share with everybody about blind audio testing. Now, this is sometimes called A-B testing or A-B-X testing, where you don't know whether it's A or B that you're listening to, but it's a long-standing methodology for trying to determine what the differences in performance might be between audio products, cables, even audio files. And I don't mean audio files, I mean audio files. what do most people think that this process reveals? Let's start there.
Okay. Well, I mean, I have to admit from the beginning that this is a topic I typically try to shy away from because it's quite a little hot potato. But
it's almost like talking about religion, I know.
Yeah, but, you know, we started talking about it a couple weeks ago, and we had a great conversation. And, you know, I've always taken the position – well, I should go back historically a little bit. The first time I was ever formally tested with an audio test scenario was back in 1989, and this was at a Stereophile show in San Mateo at the Dunphy Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really participated in an organized test before. John Atkinson did this one. And so you can imagine there's 50 or 60 of us in a room, and he's got a big set of B&W speakers, and he's testing the difference between an ADCOM amp and a VTL tube amp, two very, very different amps, different price ranges, different technologies. And so he was doing basically a blind test in the room, and they had a big screen up, so he couldn't tell what amp was being played. Anyways, the test went through, and myself and one other person in the room scored 6 out of 7 correct, identifying which amp was which during this test. But what dawned on me was the other person in the room was also an industry expert, and the rest of the folks were, you know, typical audio showgoers and so forth. And I started realizing that the test itself was testing us, the audience, in terms of how well we could listen. It wasn't actually telling us anything about the equipment. And so I started thinking about that a lot, and one thing led to another, and I started realizing that whenever someone talks about an A-B test or an A-B-X test, they're using that in the context of what's the difference between this piece of equipment or not, or is there no difference, for example, between these two wires? Is there no difference between these two amplifiers, or is there a difference? But in reality, what the test does is it tests whether the audience listening at the time can detect a difference or not, and really nothing else. It doesn't tell us anything about the technology per se. It tells us about the human's perception of the technology.
Well, certainly there is a school of thought that says that amps all sound the same. I've heard people say that. Can that possibly be true?
Well, it's all a matter of degree. This is why I think the blind testing is it's a tricky subject, because what happens is let's say you test a room full of people, and let's say that one or two people in that room, maybe 20 people, can hear the difference between two amplifiers every single time. They get it right every single time. But statistically, they don't represent really anything significant. So most people in the room, let's say, are 50-50 and don't have a significant result. The conclusion there would be that there's no difference between the amplifiers. But I would say, no, the conclusion is that particular audience in that particular room didn't, in general, statistically tell the difference. But it doesn't say that there's no difference between the amplifiers. And I think that's a really important point to understand, because, in fact, if one person gets it right every single time, day in, day out, you know, maybe we'll call them a golden ear. When we get past the point of them being lucky and it starts turning out that they can, in fact, detect the differences, now what we're dealing with is the fact that some listeners are more skilled to hear those differences than others. And so any given test in a room full of people is going to essentially assess how skilled your room full of people is. It's not really going to be any scientific. There's no scientific conclusion you can deduce from that saying that those amps do or don't sound different. What you're going to determine is whether your particular room and the people in the room were able to tell that difference.
Hmm. But if at least some people can reliably tell the difference, as you have postulated here, doesn't that indicate that there is, in fact, some difference between them? If at least one person can reliably over a long period of time, many trials, many tests, reliably say, yes, that's amp B and that's amp A, or cable A and cable B. Can't we conclude that there is, in fact, some difference there, whether or not everyone can hear it? If at least one person can hear it, wouldn't that indicate that?
Yeah, well, I would think so. But, once again, to be as honest as possible about it, you would say that that particular person in that series of tests heard the difference. I mean, that's your conclusion. Once again, if you want to test those amps and you want to test them with test equipment, then you can measure and you can verify what those differences are and quantify them. But when we're talking about human beings here and what the human thinks, that's a different matter. And so I think what we started talking about a few weeks ago and what started this this conversation, which ended up now with this podcast, is, the idea that a lot of folks use A/B tests and different blind testing methods in audio to try to determine if there's a difference between amplifiers. And I'm saying, well, if there's a difference between the amplifiers, that's one thing. But what you're really testing is whether the people, once again, in the room, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but whether the people in that room in that situation can tell the difference. I mean, that's the only viable result. And one thing to think about is think about the nature of audio tests compared to how blind tests are used, for example, in medical trials, which is where blind tests come to us and where we're probably more used to them. In a medical trial, there's no skill involved, or there's no listening learning curve, or a learning curve in terms of telling between two different medical treatments if the test is done right. Your body has a physical reaction or not, and it's measured. So there's a blind test, and the result is fairly valid. But a listening test is something where the different listeners in the room can bring their skills and their pre-knowledge to the environment. So it's almost like it's an Olympics of listeners as opposed to a test. Well, I mean, think about it. Some people are better at pole vaulting than others, and some people are better at listening and have developed skills. And so, the example I always find interesting is Michael Fremer. I know he's been on your show. He's a big mouth. But one thing he says, which I...
a very interesting guy and a very smart guy.
Yeah, but one thing that he said, and we've talked about this a few times, and I've watched him take blind tests, and he pretty much aces every single one I've ever seen him take. And there's the example of the guy who does that, and I've seen that documented, and it calls to mind the idea that here's a trained listener who knows how to listen what he's listening for. And in the few tests that I've taken, if the right environment, once I've learned myself, learned what's going on in the test, I found that it's really easy to do better and to improve your score over time. So, once again, I draw the conclusion that these tests are really testing the abilities of the listeners. I don't know that you can draw any valid absolute conclusion about the equipment itself under test. And the other thing to keep in mind is that people have preferences. And so somebody might prefer the sound of something that's not technically as accurate as something else. I'm really going to open a can of worms here, but turntables maybe would be a good example of that. My personal view is that turntables offer a very pleasing distortion of what was recorded in the studio, but it's pleasing in a way that we really like. It's like rose-colored glasses. And the artifacts in reproduction with turntables, very, very fine high-end turntables, still involves different kinds of artifacts due to the physical media in terms of, for example, bass is usually summed to mono to give it the ability for the needle to track in the groove, which boosts the bass a little bit. You get some compression in the dynamics and so forth. But these are all pleasing things to a listener. So if you were listening to a turntable in a digital file, you might say, I prefer the sound of the turntable. That doesn't speak to whether it's more accurate. It doesn't speak to whether or not it's a more proper representation of the original source. But it simply denotes that that particular person preferred that sound at that time. And I think that's a very valid response. I'm not saying it's not, but it's different than saying we can prove that turntables sound better than something else or worse than something else. When people say that it sounds better, I think what they're saying is, I just like the sound more. When I hear the word better, in my mind, I'm thinking, does it sound more accurate? But I don't know if most listeners think of the word better as meaning more accurate, because I would go down fighting saying that no turntable is as accurate as a properly sourced digital file that's being reproduced. So when it comes to better being accurate, you know, all respect to Neil Young, but, an analog turntable record result of one of his albums, it's going to sound good. It might sound better in terms of your feeling about that album, but I'm sure it's not going to sound better in terms of accuracy. And so, you know, we have to be careful to differentiate what the word better means, you know, in among all these other things that we're discussing.
True enough. A couple things come to mind. One is, you know, it's almost impossible for the average listener to know what is accurate, right? Because they weren't there at the recording session. They didn't hear what the engineers heard while they were recording, while they were mixing, mastering, duplicating. So by the time it gets to you, you really don't know what accurate is. So really all you can do is say what you like, which is, of course, a subjective opinion.
And think about this, though. The artists themselves recording the album probably are not hearing what they heard in the studio because of the different steps involved. And, you know, provenance in terms of a digital file is becoming a hot topic these days. But it gets even more interesting when you start thinking about how albums are recorded. And I'm talking about pop albums right now. Let's set aside, for example, the purest two-mic classical recording. Mm-hmm. You know, a pop album in the studio, it's a manufactured artifact of all the different things and all the different takes and the different microphones and setups and so forth. There is no there. There's no reality of the performance. What there is it's like a painting where the artists have picked all kinds of different colors, different brushes, and they're rendering their effects. They're looking for a final product based on, all those artificial manipulations. It's an art process. And then when they're done, the album is mixed. There's a mixing engineer. When that's done, the final tape is sent to a mastering engineer. The mastering engineer then changes it and sweetens it based on his idea of what it should sound like. And there's several steps involved here. So what happens is the artist may have heard one thing when he had the headphones on and was recording in the studio. What comes out at the other end is not probably what he even heard. And so what is the objective reality of a Beatles recording? There is none. I mean, you know, it's so the only thing you can fall back on is really – there's something on the tape, and it's very technical in nature in terms of the impulses, whether it's magnetic analog tape or whether it's digital bits encoded. And so there's something there. And so what we're trying to do is reproduce technically as accurate as possible what was originally captured. Now, that may not be subjectively what we think is better. In other words, it may not sound as wonderful then to hear the exact master tape of the Beatles recordings, you know, maybe a little sweetening, maybe putting them into a, on a vinyl LP makes them sound a little bit more palatable. But the fact is, it's a really slippery thing when you try to figure out what reality is. So you compare what you're hearing in your room against quote unquote reality. It just, the closer you look at it, it's one of those things, the farther it seems to go away. So it's kind of a tough item.
Yeah.
But there are certain things which ring true. So audiophile recordings typically, you know, try to record in a very simple, straightforward fashion, a voice, a bass, drums, piano in a room. And so it'll ring true or not. And a lot of people use the test where, you know, they'll be in the other room. And if they hear their system playing and if they think there's actually something in the room, in other words, they're fooled to think there's a live person in the room, then, that's one of those indications that maybe they're getting close to reproducing. But keep in mind, the engineer chooses the microphone, which colors how things sound, how close the person is to the microphone, you know, what kind of compressors they're going to use, on and on and on. It's so subjective.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned to you in that conversation that I had spoken with Bob Ludwig, one of the best-known mastering engineers ever. And, you know, he acknowledged, and I think this is true, that we were talking about the difference between standard resolution, CD resolution recordings versus high resolution. And I was asking him whether or not if you have a tape, a master tape, say, from 30 or 40 years ago, that probably doesn't have the extra information that would be captured with high resolution, why would you digitize it in high resolution? He said, well, there is sometimes some information up there, depending on how the tape was stored and the mixing console that it went through and so on. But the biggest influence is how it is remastered. And that is where most people hear the biggest difference, is that I went back to the master tape and I remastered it, you know, based upon what I know now, as opposed to 30 or 40 years ago. So I think your point there is very well taken.
Well, and think about what the term remaster means. What, and maybe people don't know this, I'm sure some do. Literally, it involves equalization at some point. And some remastering engineers will or will not equalize, but they all have the ability to sweeten and to change the equalization of the recording, the original recording. They can change the dynamics. And once again, why would they do that? Because they have in their own mind, a reality they're looking for, or a sound, a pleasure sound. They're going to put their name on it, so they want it to be a pleasing sound. So they may, in fact, change. There's what's called flat transfer, and maybe we've heard that. I've seen some releases recently where, on DVD audio or Blu-ray, for example, where you can get the high-resolution remixed version, the remastered version, and then maybe a flat transfer straight from the tape where they did not perform any EQ or dynamic changes. And so those are becoming available, but there's a bigger can of worms here, which you just touched on, which is the whole idea of comparing formats without having identical masterings from which to do so. So, for example, the release that came out on LP, that master tape might not be the master tape they're using for the release on 2496 HD, for example, or even CD. They might have had three different masters for those three different mediums. And so a lot of times I see people try to compare the mediums. Oh, the CD blows away the LP, the LP blows away the CD, the HD doesn't sound as good as the CD. Well, the first thing you've got to check are, did those come from identical sources? And you use the example of the 30-year-old tape. Tapes over time, analog tapes, do change. I mean, physically, they lose fidelity, and the more time a tape is played, there is a detrimental effect. And so a mono Beatles release, first pressing on Parlophone, might in fact sound different and better, and maybe even preserve more information than the same mono recording remastered 2 years ago, for example, to high resolution. I mean, the tape itself might have changed in that period of time. So, there's just so many variables here that and we could talk about this maybe as a topic coming up shortly, but there's so many variables that getting a rational test put together to actually compare formats and to try to bring some reality to this is really difficult.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I'm involved in such a test, which we're going to talk about shortly. But in the meantime, let me get to a couple of comments here in the chat room. Charlie X says a remaster could be a flat transfer. So he anticipated your comment there about strictly a flat transfer. SoundPro 69 says, I think that the idea, if we cannot provide exactly what the artist had in mind, then it's okay for us to knowingly use less accuracy to please ourselves, seems a bit self-serving. I'm not sure. Go ahead.
Well, but that's interesting point, because every situation is different. But I've been involved in recordings, and where we anticipate that the mastering engineer is going to change it. And so, for example, one recording that I remember mixing, we didn't worry about the bottom end so much because we knew the mastering engineer was going to change and clean up the bottom end. You know, so. There's some interdependency there, but I think the one example that comes to mind is, for example, some of the Yes recordings have been released where you can hear the flat transfer in addition to new remixes, and also I've got some of the original HD transfers that were made from some of the old masters. And, you know, the flat transfer is the most honest. And to be honest, when I'm comparing equipment and comparing DACs, I review digital audio equipment for stereophiles. So I'm listening to DAX a lot, listening to these high-resolution formats. In that particular case, I have to admit, the flat transfer maybe was the least pleasing of them all. So in terms of pleasing, definitely I think it was at the bottom of the list. But in terms of most accurate to what they had in the studio that they mixed at that point, you know, clearly leaving aside the idea that over 30 years that there's going to be some deterioration of the tape. But so that's more accurate. So that is a problem because mastering engineers and taste changes over time. You know, there's a period in the 80s where we compress the heck out of stuff. And you know, now you listen to recordings. I mean, the new Lord disc, well, from a couple years ago, that was huge. There's incredible amounts of bottom end on that disc. And a lot of the albums that come out have some really prodigious bass. And it's a whole different mastering style than you listen to, for example, the new Creedence remasters, the 2014 HD remasters, which by standards of some of the modern music is very lean in the bottom end, but it's still very accurate to what was originally there. I mean, tastes change and tastes vary, so it's really tough. We could talk about structuring a way of actually determining, for example, differences in formats, our perception and how we listen and hear differences in formats. But when it gets into mastering and albums and all that, there's so much art involved and so much subjectivity that it's tough. I mean, we could go around in circles on that. So
Right. Well, let's not do that. I would like to hear what you have to say about structuring, how we might approach this whole problem that we're talking about. But before we do, Drew Nielsen asks, so do tapes lose quality over time even if they're not played? I think that depends on how they're stored in part. Generally speaking, yes, they do, right?
Yeah, they do. In fact, one of the things when I was recording back in the mid-80s, we used what's called Ampex 456 tape. It was one of the tapes we used a lot. And those tapes have known to have a problem where the tape itself, the oxide particles on the tape, the binder that they used to bind the oxide particles onto the Mylar became sticky over time. And so the tapes got kind of sticky and they would shed all over the tape head. So a lot of people that went back for CD remastering found out that when they put those tapes on the machines, they were starting to shed oxide all over the place. They then discovered you could bake the tape, and baking the tape essentially refixed that binder. But you only then had about one or two chances to play the tape properly and make a transfer, and after that, you were pretty much lost. And so there's a whole group of tapes that went through that process that I don't think will ever sound the same. At the same time, and by the way, those tapes could have just been sitting in a box for 20 years and not played ever. So they just simply, naturally, the chemical process deteriorated. But I've also seen and read in some of the professional journals that a lot of the tape particles themselves, you know, we're talking about little teeny pieces of metal that are oriented, their polarities are oriented when you're recording.
Right.
And over time, they tend to go back to where they were. And so they tend to unorient. And I don't want to get too far into something I don't know a lot about, but what I've read, the conclusion I've come to, just what I've read, is that what that leads to is loss of high frequency and loss of dynamic impact over time from tapes that are stored for a long period.
Mm-hmm. Sandblaster in the chat room is asking, aren't all songs today mastered for peak volume for radio or MP3? Ergo, almost all of today's mastering is not as good as days gone past. He brings up the point, and I think what he's referring to here is dynamic compression, and you mentioned that as well. In the 80s, there was a big craze for it, and I think still today in pop music, they compress the dynamic range quite a bit in order to sound, to level the volume on the radio and when you're driving in your car and stuff like that. So with popular music, that's still a big issue, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, a lot of times you'll find I collect multiple recordings. An album I like, I'll collect four or five remasterings of it. And you'll see in over time how they'll start squashing the dynamics. And an old recording, let alone the newer recordings, but an old recording could get remastered. This happens every once in a while on HD tracks. Somebody will get a new remastering and the dynamics are squashed. Nirvana comes to mind, their album Nevermind, the new release that came out a year or two ago, the dynamics were much less than it was before, which weren't that great to start with. Mm. So old recordings that are remastered can fall victim to this. At the same time, there are mastering engineers who care about this, and so I wouldn't paint it too broadly. I mean, I don't have accurate percentages. I'm going to guess that there's something like 20 or 30% of these modern recordings that are probably handled properly, but yes, the tendency is louder is better, and so you can squash the dynamic range and get the apparent loudness up. I mean, but there's nothing worse in the world than finding an album that you really like, and then when you hear it on a good system, it sounds terrible. And that happens all the time, unfortunately.
Yeah. F-Loop in the chat room is asking an interesting question. The objectivist camp, and we want to talk a little bit about objectivists versus subjectivists, but the objectivist audiophile camp promotes the following conjecture, that all amplifiers, preamps, D-Day converters, and so on, meeting or exceeding some set of specifications, are indistinguishable in blind testing from others, also meeting or exceeding those same specs. What do you think of this basic idea? Does such a set of specs exist?
I listen to a lot of DACs. I've probably in the last 2 years listened to 30 or 40 DACs under very rigorous listening conditions, and I've drawn a few conclusions. I mean, I'm not a designer, so what I'm doing is just simply listening and hearing and going back and forth and testing. And there's a few things that I found, which is filters make a big difference. So what the DAC designer chose in terms of his filter is going to make a huge difference. And other things which happen all the time is DACs have slightly different output levels, so you have to equalize those very carefully. But yes, once you eliminate those variables, DACs can start sounding very similar, but there's other variables. Power supply, for example, the clock, the accuracy of the clock. The MSB DAC comes to mind because their clock is so accurate, and also the Antelope Zodiac. The clock used in the DAC can make a difference. So if I'm to understand the question properly, if you take into account all those different design choices and equalize for all those, I mean, essentially you end up with the same design and the same result. Another way to put this is DACs cluster really close in terms of sound quality. A review that I just posted on Stereophile that I did of the Zodiac, the Antelope Zodiac Platinum DAC, the best analogy I could come up with was milkshakes. And people that know me know that I like my milkshakes. But the thing about milkshakes is different flavors like chocolate, strawberry. I mean, to me, those represent the differences between different speakers. We're talking milkshakes, but when you're talking different flavors, it's like speakers. You've got big ones, small ones, subwoofers, no subwoofers. In other words, they all sound pretty noticeably different in the room. I don't think there's anybody that would be able that would walk into a room and not be able to tell the difference between two different, you know, speakers, just like two different flavors of milkshake. But DACs, on the other hand, are like a single flavor, a single recipe, let's say chocolate milkshake. The only variable you're changing is the source of the cocoa in the milkshake. In other words, everything else is held steady, but you're changing the source of the cocoa and maybe a little sweetness, maybe just a few grains of sugar back and forth. So you can say that, in fact, these recipes are designed, you know, the recipe is the same, but the design that each chef brings to the recipe is slightly different, and that difference might be the cocoa powder. But once somebody learns to taste those differences, they could probably predictably taste which cocoa powder came from, you know, which country pretty reliably. And the same thing with DACs is the differences cluster. The DACs cluster so much more closely. A $300 DAC and a $3,000 DAC basically sound the same. I mean, they basically do. But when you get into the finer points and you really start hammering at it, you can reliably pick out what the difference is. And that may come down to just simply the choice the designer made, for example, the filter, the power supply, and so forth. So, you know, I think it's kind of right in the sense that if the filter and the design and so forth is similar, two DACs that are built the same way, they're going to sound the same. But because the designer, there are a bunch of variables. And there's subtle variables that they all bring into play here. So some of those variables count for more difference than others. But when you really get to it and you start listening with a fine-tooth comb, you can catch out those differences. An example I like to use in terms of what those differences are like is this. Is you look at two brand-new cars on a parking lot, right? You're going to buy a car. You have two identical cars next to each other, same color, same model, same everything, right? Mm-hmm. But on one car, you notice a teeny little ding in the door. Now, as far as a car goes, and you know everything that a car is, those cars are identical, functional, everything else. But the ding on the door, once you see it, you can't not see it. And so right. What happens with DAC listening a lot is, to me, when I first get a DAC, I'll be honest, I can't tell what it sounds like. It sounds just like the DAC I had before. In other words, you know, they all sound pretty much the same. But once you listen to it enough and you finally hear that little ding, once you get that, then for that period of time, you can pretty reliably pick it out. So listening sessions are kind of interesting that way with DACs, is that you can pick out that little ding and you can then repeatedly test. Sometimes we do this with members from our audio club, the Central Coast Audio Club, which, by the way, is the best audio club in the country.
I have no doubt of that whatsoever.
central coast of California, a great bunch of guys. But so I always, whenever I'm testing DAC, I always try to get two or three of them to come over, and we blind test each other, listening, so that we can start zeroing in on what these DACs are doing. And at first, we're kind of lost. We're kind of just grasping for things. But then once we nail it, once we see that ding in the door, then you can always tell which car has the ding and which one doesn't. Now, what's fun, interesting to me is a month later, if you took that DAC away and then a month later you brought it back to me, I'd have to ramp up and learn it again. In other words, I'd have to figure out that difference again. And once I got it, I could reliably pick it out. And so when I start looking at testing, you know, and differences in testing with DACs, that learning and that learning process and so forth leading up to how the DAC is actually tested, I think is really important. And, you know, I guess at the end of the day, what I'm finding is, yes, DACs cluster real close, but once you catch what the difference is, you can pretty much call them out. Now, whether that difference is important or significant enough to make somebody spend an extra $3,000, that's, I have no idea.
Really. That's up to the individual, of course.
Yeah.
And one thing you said there just kind of caught my attention, which was, you know, if you come back a month later or 2 months later, you kind of have to relearn. You're talking about their audio memory, which is another interesting facet of this whole discussion, which is how long can you retain that really detailed perceptive experience before a month or two goes by and you kind of lost it and you kind of have to kind of have to relearn it.
Well, yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, the example I used with the car ding, I mean, I could imagine a scenario where those two cars could be left in the garage and a year you come back and you forget where the ding is. And so you have to search over and until you can tell the difference. So up until the point that you find the ding again, they're again the same. Same thing with DACs. I find that if the DAC has an obvious characteristic, and I'll pick on one, for example, the Riga DAC, which we had here about 3 years ago, it had a very noticeable little bit of a bass bump, and John actually found that in the measurements. John Atkinson, when he measured, found that after we did the listening. But there was a noticeable bass bump. So that's something that sticks in your memory and is much easier to, you know, it imprints on you much deeper. But, for example, the last three DACs I had here, which were all excellent DACs, the Antelope Zodiac, the MSB, and then we've got the new Benchmark DAC, those were pretty close. They were shades. You know, those were where the little chocolate cocoa might have been changed a little bit. And I have to be honest, a month later, I'd have to start all over again to pick those out. And so I would never basically say that, oh, yeah, 6 months ago I heard this and it sounds so much better than that kind of thing. It just doesn't work that way.
Right, right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so I guess this is one of the tricky things is, so because that's the nature of it, and, you know, I'm just trying to be honest in how I perceive it in my personal experience. I know that audio companies who produce a DAC, they want to make you think that that DAC now slaughters everything and that everything else is, you know, chopped liver. And now this new DAC has changed the environment. I've rarely, this is going to sound like heresy to the manufacturers, but I've rarely heard a DAC that all of a sudden changes my whole perception, with one exception, which we can talk about. But really, it's rare that that ever happens. And so, you know, to the average consumer out there, it becomes a really tricky thing because DACs have features. So let's say all the features are the same. When it gets down to listening, there are subtle differences. And once you hear them, and if you can listen to a DAC from there on out, you are going to prefer one over the other. But there's that discovery period to get there. So, you know, how important is that? I always tell people in the end, you've got to listen to yourself for yourself. You've got to compare for yourself because what's important to me, you know, that little ding in the door might matter more to me than it does to you.
Right, exactly. So what was that DAC that was the exception to that general rule?
Oh, well, the one that surprised me actually was the Air QB9. And this was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Air, spelled A-Y-R-E, had a DAC called the QB9. It was a USB-only input DAC. But they had put a filter in that Meridian also uses called an appetizing filter. So it was a unique filtering approach at the time. And I remember we were listening to a Roxy Music song, a buddy, audio buddy of mine, and we both, the Air DAC had already been reviewed by somebody, so I was using it as a baseline to compare to something else I was reviewing, and I don't remember what, but I remember we put the Air DAC in, we put on a Roxy Music cut from a remastering that sounded pretty good, and we both Bruce and I looked at each other, and we thought, wow, that sounds like a master tape playing in the room. I mean, that, it reminded me for the first time, with a digital and with DAC, and this is several years ago, but for the first time, it reminded me of that effect of running a master tape right across the heads live in the studio. It had that presence all of a sudden. And so That one stood out, and a lot of DAX now have caught up to that since. I mean, it doesn't differentiate itself like it did, but, you know, that was several years ago, but it did stand out at the time.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first one to use this appetizing filter, which is was different than other filters at the time. Now other people are using it as well.
Yeah, I don't quote me on that. I don't know if it, for a fact it was the very
it
first
It may not
one
be the very first yeah. one. Sure. No, I understand.
Meridian is an audio company. Meridian Audio is also known to use the appetizing filter, and you know, that in itself, the appetizing filter, what does that mean? Audio designer, I just jump into this real quickly because that's one of the differences that you can call out between DACs, and some DACs actually let you choose filter selection. Other DACs, the designer makes a choice for you, and that's the filter you get. But on a DAC that lets you select the filter, you can, that's something where I think you can reliably, you get a group of people and you can listen and you train them and you spend an hour. I think they could reliably start hearing the difference between the, you know, say four different filter settings. And so there's an effect that it's a designer choice. And some DACs use the same filter, some don't. But if there's a difference in the sound, the filter is going to have a lot to do with it, I think.
Mm. That kind of reminds me of the designer's choice, the mastering engineer's choice, sort of a similar thing there of, what does the designer of the DAC think is the most important or the best sounding? He's going to build that for him or her, as the mastering engineer is going to EQ or not, or do whatever they're going to do to make the final product sound as good as it can to that person.
Yeah, and you know, for example, the one of the DACs which I reviewed, which I really liked, was the MSB Analog DAC, and the name says it all. It's the Analog DAC. What they're trying to do is, in a sense, give you a sense of listening to analog, which that QB9, the Air QB9 DAC at that point, I remember just thinking to myself, wow, this, because I've, on that same system in my listening room, I've played back master tapes, you know, on analog 30 IPS, reel-to-reel, you know, half-inch or 2-inch machines. So there's a certain sound that that has, just an immediacy. So that's that. You could call that an analog sound, I suppose. But even the word analog, you know, that means different things to different people. But what they're trying to tell you is it doesn't have that mid-range hardness. It doesn't have a kind of a steely digital sound, I think, is what they're trying to communicate with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you'll pardon me for just a moment, I would like to, before we continue, mention to our viewers and listeners, all of whom are fans of Twit, and many of whom I'm sure shop on Amazon. And I just want to make sure you know that on twit.tv, the website that hosts this show and many others, there is a special feature that lets you shop at Amazon as you normally would. Doesn't cost you anything at all, but it helps Twit keep the lights on at the Brick House. All you have to do is go to twit.tv/Amazon and click on that Amazon banner over on the right. It will take you right to Amazon.com and you can shop as usual. Twit will benefit from that and you'll be able to help keep the lights on, which is a very good thing. I've been shopping there quite a bit lately. In fact, I recently purchased a book. An ebook. It comes in printed and ebook form by my aunt, believe it or not. Her name is Dora Kuntz, and she developed a holistic healing technique called therapeutic touch. And so I've recently been rereading some of her books. She's long dead now, unfortunately, but before she passed away, she developed this technique, and I find it very interesting. So I just recently picked up this book called The Spiritual Dimensions of Therapeutic Touch, which is basically written by her, transcribed from lectures that she had given. So I found that fascinating, and having a connection to my own family past, which is really cool. Of course, you can also go on Amazon Instant Video, and there have been a number of new releases put on Amazon Instant Video, including one of my favorite movies of all time, Blade Runner, The Final Cut. There have been so many cuts of this movie, but any of them to me is fine. I really enjoy them quite a bit. So that is definitely one that I strongly recommend from Amazon Instant Video, which you can get if you're a member of Amazon Prime for free. So it's really very, very cool. So again, that's the twit.tv/Amazon. And head on over to that banner on the right and click on that. You'll get right to Amazon.com, be able to make your purchases, and you'll be helping Twit at the same time. So we really appreciate that very much. In fact, it's a very easy way to support Twit. We recommend that you bookmark that page and then click through the link every time. You can even go to Amazon UK and Canada, which is very good for those of our friends who live in those countries as well. Once again, that's twit.tv/Amazon, and we thank you very much for your support. Okay, John, one thing that occurred to me a little while ago when you were talking about differences between turntables and whether or not they're pleasing or not, tube amps and solid state amps is another example of I think tube amps, I'm not sure anybody would argue that they're quote-unquote accurate. They often introduce distortions, but they're very pleasing distortions, which is, I think, why a lot of people like them, don't you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, and boy, you're opening another can of worms here, aren't you?
I'm just all about opening cans of worms today.
Yeah, there's some tube equipment that arguably tries to be as accurate as possible, more accurate than others. But in general, we're talking about different types of second order, third order harmonic distortion. And so tubes are very graceful in how they handle overload and so forth. I mean, obviously, they're used to great effect in guitar amps and that kind of thing. But I've heard a lot of tube amps that sound pretty darn accurate. So maybe I'm not going to go there as much.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
Yeah. I've yet to hear on a very challenging recording. And once again, Royals, the song Royal from Lord is a good example. Right. I've heard that reproduced on extremely expensive turntables and streamed to a high resolution audio. And it changes the sound fairly dramatically from what I would consider to be the HD version that I would listen to. And so there's an audible difference. I don't think anybody would not hear the difference between the two. Now, you could argue as to which one you liked better, but in terms of which one was more accurate between the turntable and the digital file, that one is just so obvious. It's almost silly.
You wrote an editorial about this that you sent me the link to. It's on stereophile.com. I don't know if it's going to be easy to say the link, the URL, but it was way back in 2005 where you reported about what you started this conversation with, that experience at the Stereophile Home Entertainment Show near San Francisco. And I thought you proposed something that was really, really interesting in that editorial, which was to play two recordings, one of which had some distortion introduced into it, and see how well people could distinguish them. And then slowly over time, playing them back and forth, reduce the amount of distortion until you got essentially a random result. I thought that was a fascinating idea.
Yeah, and what you're doing there as well is, to my point that what you're really testing is the audience, is you're going to be eliminating certain listeners from the success of making those choices. I think what you would see is certain listeners the attrition of success would start increasing as the distortion went down. Mm-hmm. But there would still be some listeners that would follow you all the way down till it became an imperceptible. And so one of the other things I thought would be kind of interesting is you could do this in such a way as to call out the best listeners out of thousands and thousands of entries. And so essentially you can end up with a panel of truly golden ear listeners that would then be able to, test, if you want to test how things sound different, why not create, first of all, a panel of experts? And the same reasoning would be, you wouldn't want to run a Grand Prix race with, 10 professional drivers and 80 amateur drivers. You want to call out the very best, and that's what you want to see. So if we're going to end up doing these tests and we're going to do them in public and then start debating and arguing over them, maybe we should originally try to do one of those talent shows where they try to find out who the best singer is in the country at that particular period of time. A best listener panel. And so you end up with this panel of 20 people. Those results I would probably put more credence in terms of if there was a difference between, say, these two cables, than a random panel of 80 people, even if they considered themselves audiophiles. I think the proof would be in the pudding, and you could sort out a group of really talented listeners that way, and then you might be more interested in the results as they would pull them in.
Yeah. Well, that brings up the idea of training, and can people train themselves? And I'm sure the answer is yes, they can. We have at least two that I know of ways in which you can train yourself to be a more critical, more refined listener. One is called the Philips Golden Ear Challenge at goldenears.philips.com. And the other is done by Harman, specifically Sean Olive, who has been a guest on this show as well. And that's at harmanhowtolisten.blogspot.com. And both of these purport to help you refine and train your hearing ability. Do you think this is there value in doing this?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, depending once again what your objective is, and if what you're trying to do is train yourself to hear differences between different audio products or, files, for example, different resolutions, each one of them, though, has a different artifact. And so the idea of training you for the process is one thing, but when it comes to a particular test, I have to say I'm not so sure, because let's say you're listening to two different digital filters. Now, there's a particular artifact that somebody who's, in other words, let's say somebody already knows what that difference is. They can then mention it in the room, and they can tell the listeners this is what to listen for. In that particular test with that particular comparison, having the hands-on person there to lead you, or having the time and luxury to be able to sit and listen to that until you find out what the difference is, I think that's the best way to get there. I mean, the desire, you have to have the curiosity and the desire, and then you have to have, I think, in a sense, the real thing in front of you. In other words, you have to have a properly designed test, an example of, say, for example, those two filters on a DAC, and then you need to sit there and listen to them under a relaxed situation until you can reliably pick them out and hear what that difference is. In other words, be able to see that little ding in the side of the door, figure out where it is. And once you do, then you can pretty much reliably make that test work for you over time. But once again, like I said, there's that learning curve in each test. I think these are good things. You asked the question, these are good things. I think they are. But when it comes to a specific test, I would never think that you could have 20 people take that course and then walk into a room and be able to succeed at two different filters, and then walk into another room and succeed at changing two different amps, walk into another room and two different cables. You're listening for different things in each case, and you need to, there's a whole training for each one of those particular examples to be able to then accurately predict those things. So I think that's why we have so much trouble with this, quite frankly, is because we all live in our own world and our own environment. And clearly what I'm saying is a product of everything I've observed and seen over time, which is not by a long shot, not the whole picture. But I think the one thing I've always felt safe to say is that any of these tests, as I've seen them designed, an audio test where people in a room listen and compare things, what you're testing is, once again, those people in the room under that circumstance, what their perception is. You're not unveiling any truth whatsoever about whether formats are, what's the differences between the formats technically or any of those kind of things. You're just doing a study on human perception, what people like and don't like in a particular situation.
Well, you mentioned files, and that brings up one of the last topics I want to talk about today, which is this experiment that I'm conducting on AVS Forum, which is basically Mark Waldrop at AIX Records records at 2496 resolution. He's very careful, very meticulous. He definitely captures the ultrasonic frequencies and the wide dynamic range. And what he does is, what we decided to do was to take three of those tracks that are confirmed to have that extra information, down convert them to 1644.1, which is the resolution of CD, and then re-up convert that back to 2496, so that in terms of looking at the files on a computer, just saying, oh, file A, file B, they both are the same size, they're both the same length in terms of kilobytes or megabytes. And so, you can't just by a glance tell which is which. And then we asked people to listen to them and tell us which one they thought was the high resolution track, A or B. And we have a picture here, actually, of the the spectrogram of of one of these tracks, and the spectrogram of at 1644 and also at 2496. Here it is here. You can see on the lower left, vertical axis is frequency, and to the right of the middle, you can see lots of information into the ultrasonic range, and on the left, it's all cut off. And now in the upper right, you can also see the same thing. The yellow curve is the frequency response of the file at 44.116 bits, and it drops right off at just after 20 kilohertz, whereas the 24-bit 96 kilohertz file extends way out into the ultrasonics. So my question for you is, have you had a chance to listen to those files, first of all?
Well, I downloaded them, and I today I tried to. I didn't, but I did look at the – so what I did was I did a shortcut as I looked at the results of the tests, and I'll just state what I think is obvious to me anyways, is what you've tested is whether or not people can perceive the difference between downsampled and upsampled files. Because to design the test in such a way that people wouldn't know what they were listening to, since you weren't conducting in a room where they didn't see what you were playing – you had to mask the size. You had to mask the difference by the size and the resolution. So you had to use this cheat, obviously, which was to down convert and up convert.
Right.
So the only thing I think we can honestly say is, and I saw your results before our broadcast. When I ran out of time, I said, "Well, I got to look at the results because he may ask this question."
I'm going to ask you about this, and we can show them to everybody here while you're talking. Hang on a second. First of all, we'll take a look at the correct responses. Which we should see here coming up here in a second. I forget. There it is. Respondent accuracy. And the red bars are those without a high resolution capable system. And I asked everybody who submitted their results to tell me what was in their system. Was it capable of reproducing these high ultrasonic frequencies and wide dynamic range? And as you can see, the non-high resolution systems, whether or not people identified none of them right, one right, two right, or all three correctly, or whether they said, "I can't hear a difference," is more or less a sort of a bell curve distribution, whereas those with a high-res audio system managed to do quite a bit better.
Yeah, so looking at your results, I mean, the first thing that occurred to me is you've proven that, once again, I'll put it in my terms,
yep,
that group of listeners in that situation, in fact, statistically determined a difference. But the difference was between a file that had been straight 2496 and a file that had been down converted and up converted. So that's the difference that they detected, that group of people at that particular period of time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the only conclusion we can draw.
Yeah, all, but that's all the on only different systems and in different rooms.
Right. So that's why I'm saying it's that sample. You know, you could run the test again next month in a different, you know, on a different website. So you got a different sample set and you might get a similar, you might get a different result. But, you know, scientifically, what you're going to want to do is, and I'm not an expert statistician, but what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to create what they would consider a significant result and then design the test to make sure you're zeroing in on, you know, what you're really listening for. And I'm assuming what you were trying to compare was the difference between a low resolution and a high resolution file, but correct.
But I admit that the fact that we went through two sample rate conversions certainly is suspect and could have introduced artifacts that would have clued people in to the difference between the files. The other option that we thought about was to actually send both the 2496 and the 1644.1 out a DAC and then back in an analog to digital converter, but that would have involved two analog digital conversions, and we decided to keep everything in the digital domain. Maybe we'll try the experiment the other way another time, or maybe not.
Well, I think you did the best you could considering the restriction of making sure people didn't know which file was which over the internet.
Right.
You know, and so given that was your method of delivery, the files, I don't know how I would be able to do it any better than you did, to be honest. But I just want to be really clear that I think realistically what your result shows is that, and what we can say you know, and assert factually is that what you've determined is that that particular group of listeners could perceive a difference between those two files, which were manipulated by down converting and up converting. And the interesting thing is when I looked at your test, it wasn't a true ABX test. It was actually just an AB test, but you didn't, you know, they didn't know which one. It could be that some people in that particular condition might like the downsampled file better. They simply might like the sound of the downsampled file better, but you know, you're asking if they could hear the difference. And so I'm not sure that your test accomplished that exactly, because asking them if they could hear a difference, they wouldn't be able to necessarily assign one as being 96 or 44.
Well, you know, that was the question. The question was, which version of each of these three files do you believe, after listening, is the high resolution version?
Right, but if you don't have a control that they know is the high resolution version, how do they? They're kind of grasping in space. In other words,
well, that's a good point.
Yeah, so you don't know what your target is, and I found this to be the case. I'll give you an example. We had an audio club meeting here a couple Sundays ago, and Philip O'Hanlon brought his hard drive, and on it he had several songs that had been mastered in various resolutions. So he didn't take something and upsample and downsampling it. He had access to the music and to mastering engineers, so he was able to get some of these files that were mastered at different resolutions, and then he would play them in sequence to us. So he started at the lower resolution, work up to the high resolution. We had about 25, 30 audio club members in the room, and we rotated. So we went through this a few times. And by the way, John Atkinson, I talked to him about that test, and John says it's much more effective if you start at the high resolution and work down to the low resolution in terms of hearing the differences, which I would guess is probably a result of when you hear the high resolution, now you've heard as good as it could sound theoretically. So what you're hearing as it goes down the chain in resolution, in other words, you've already learned now what the best can sound like. So now you're going to hear compared to that. In other words, that's your standard of comparison. But we did it the opposite way. But everybody in the room, most people in the room felt like over time that they could reliably hear it. Now, this was not a blind test. So this was not a situation. I don't want to picture it as a blind test. But what we did was we listened to files that had been mastered in those individual cases at those different resolutions. And so it wasn't a matter of upconverting and downconverting, which was the case with your particular test. So, you know, that if that can be possibly done in a controlled environment, you know, say at an AES convention or something, and use original source files that have been converted that way. And there's an awful lot of other parameters that probably have to be controlled for. But I think we'd start getting more at the heart of our humans' perception of those resolution differences and what they mean to us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that would be one way I would try to go at it.
Sure, sure. Well, we have said from the beginning that this is not a scientific test. It's just an exploration, an experiment, just, you know, to see what's what. You mentioned that you know, you had access to different mastered versions of the same recording. Is that true? It's the same recording? Because in that case, there would have to have been some sample rate conversions occurring between them, right?
Well, what Philip has done is taken, he had an original analog source, and now...
source, of course, and then he digitized that at different resolutions. Okay, I got you.
Correct, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and one of the discussions that comes up a lot in our world is DSD versus PCM, and,
yes,
you know, to open another can of worms. the thing there I've got a ton of DSD files. I've got, you know, I had a ton of SACDs. I've got a lot of high resolution PCM files. But what's really important is to hear a simultaneous comparison between a DSD and a PCM master from the same analog source. And it gets complicated, though. Let's say you're doing it at the same time. So you're sending one stream, one analog feed to this PCM converter and one analog feed to a DSD converter. Now, all of a sudden, you've got two different converters. So you've introduced that variable.
Right.
But I don't know what you can do about that. But let's say you've got one converter. So you use the same model, and it's got a PCM switch and it's got a DSD switch. And hopefully that they've emphasized designing both of them to their optimum. You know, at that point, you can capture a result and compare them. I think that's the first step in terms of a valid comparison between the formats. I've not done that. The people that I've talked to who have done that, mastering engineers in studios who have them there, I get different opinions. And so I've heard them say when you do it that way, they're really darn close, indistinguishable. Others will stake their business model on the fact that TSD might sound better, for example, to them. So it's really tough. That's one of those things that I think is going to be pretty much a crapshoot, because the actual end user, like us on the street, we're going to get the result of that chain of events. And to be able to rationally compare a DSD and PCM format requires that the chain of the provenance has to be identical in both instances, with only the switch being in that conversion process. And it's really difficult to find that and to be able to do a rational comparison like that. So
yeah,
I consider that one of those things that is still an open question that we don't know yet the answer to that. At least I don't feel like I've seen a proper answer to that.
Right. Another way to do it that I've thought about, which would be even more difficult, is to record a musician, ideally probably a single musician, using the same microphones, using two different microphones, say let's do it mono, and the signal goes directly into, again, two different digitizers, analog to digital converters, one PCM, one DSD, or one at 1644.1, one at 2496, and record them that way without involving any sample rate conversion. Same thing as what you're talking about if you have an analog tape, an analog master tape, which may or may not have the additional information in it. Here I'm talking about high resolution versus CD resolution. Without introducing any sample rate conversions or anything like that, you're just recording directly into a digital domain. Analog tape might not have that information, whereas certainly if you make sure that the instrument can do it, like cymbals or, you know, any number of instruments have ultrasonic energy in them, that would be a valid way to do it as well. But it would involve, you know, a tremendous amount of work.
Well, one thing I have done or been involved in is in studio situations where we're recording digitally, and you can sample, you can change the sample rate from, say, 24 bits, but you can change it from 44 to 48 to 96. So you're recording a live microphone, you're recording onto your hard drive, and you can make that artistic choice or that engineering choice, technical choice. And when you're there and you're flipping the switch, so you're using the same encoder and you're using the same software and so forth, in those situations, pretty much it's always seemed pretty obvious what you're gaining and losing when you're moving up and down the resolution chain. So, and by obvious, I mean, once again, these are closely clustered things probably to most people, but obvious in the sense that once you hear what the difference is, you reliably hear it every single time you switch. And so then you just make a decision as to what format and how much hard drive space you've got and so forth. But in that particular studio environment, and I think if a lot of listeners were able to go into that studio environment and play with that switch and have the live musician there, I think they would all agree. I'm projecting here, but I think they would all agree that at some point they'll all of a sudden say, yeah, there is a difference. I reliably hear it, even though Nyquist theory tells me that there shouldn't be. But and that's a whole nother discussion as to why there is a difference. You know, is it the filtering? Is it the fact that the higher resolution allows you to do a different filtering process? Is the filtering taking place farther outside of the listening range? But, you know, in the experiences I've had, I've definitely been able to pick out those differences pretty straightforward. And Scott, I'm imagining you might have even been in some of those environments as well.
Indeed. I've been in plenty of recording studios in my time. I've never performed that particular type of experiment, though, which I would love to do, and I hope I get to at some point. So it sounds to me, my last question to you is, do you believe there's a benefit to high-resolution audio, what Neil Young is talking about? And I don't mean, you know, upscaling CDs to high resolution, which some people do and claim that that's high resolution, but true high resolution audio captured, reproduced in high resolution. Do you think there's a benefit there?
Yes. Yeah, I would say so. And I think probably just that last example I gave, and you know, what I've heard in the studio is if the signal is not monkeyed with to any great extent, I would of course like to hear more closely what they recorded at the actual event. And I've been convinced, just what I've listened to in the studio in that environment, that in fact higher resolutions give you more of the there, if you will. Mm-hmm. But one thing to keep in mind is, all that aside, the quality of the mastering, in my mind, is going to make more of a difference probably overall than resolution. I mean, if we're going to rank what makes a difference to the consumer mm-hmm. product, mm-hmm. the mastering, the quality of the mastering, I would say, is the number one thing that, you know, well, first of all, you've got to start with a good recording, of course.
Right.
But let's say you've got the good recording. The second thing I think that matters most is the mastering. And the third thing I think that matters is the resolution. I mean, to a point, MP3s, I've heard them slaughter some decent recordings, but we're talking about CD or better.
Correct. That's what we're talking about.
So I would say the mastering is number one, the resolution number two, and then format PCM versus DSD probably number three in terms of its influence or impact on the sound of the final product.
Mm-hmm. Charlie X in the chat room is wondering if, 192 kilohertz 24-bit is really necessary.
You know, it's
Is there a point beyond which it really doesn't make any difference?
I'm going to hesitate to say. I'm going to hedge on that one only because I think, once again, and under certain circumstances, under controlled conditions where I've been, you know, I've played with those things, I've definitely perceived a difference. I've heard people tell me, oh, it's night and day. I haven't heard the night and day thing, but I have heard the subtle difference. Under certain environments, I've got a lot of HD recordings that are both 2496 and 24192. Here's the tough thing is, I don't know whether the 2496 was downsampled from the 24192. So that's what I'm hearing, you know, because you clearly proved in your test that those listeners in that room could perceive the difference between a downsampled, upsampled file and an untouched file. So maybe that downsampling process is why I think the 192 sounds better. So I'm going to hedge a little on that one because the provenance on a lot of these HD recordings, that's one of the challenges I hope the industry solves, because I would love to get an HD file and in black and white, simple to understand terms, it told me exactly what iterations it went through, what resolutions, and how it got to what it is. And then the kind of questions you're asking about, the difference, we can try to rationalize, you know, in a way, very rational way, start determining what general listeners like, perceive, and don't perceive. There's always going to be those golden ear listeners who are going to say, yes, absolutely, I hear the difference, I want it, I can't live without it. You know, it's a bell curve. And so all those guys in the middle, they may be ambivalent. We may learn that they are ambivalent, and then the people at the bottom don't care if it's MP3 or not. So we get this bell curve. You know, so that's likely how it's going to turn out. Now, what do we do with that? That's all marketing and business, I suppose.
And not the subject of this show, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, great. We've come to the end of a fascinating hour, and I want to thank you so much for being here. John Iverson is the web monkey for Stereophile and its related websites, and also writes for Stereophile and a true audiophile, in my own opinion, and in the estimation of many others. John, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, Scott, thank you so much. It was fun.
Good. Glad you enjoyed it. You can read John's stuff and much more at stereophile.com. And you can find me, of course, online at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at avsforum. And you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg. Or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be Craig Eggers and Brett Crockett from Dolby to talk about Dolby Atmos in the home. This in preparation for Cedia, where there will be a lot of demos of Dolby Atmos in the home. And I look forward very much to talking with Craig and Brett about that technology coming home. So I hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.